100 years ago today, two teams of explorers were racing to the South Pole, aiming to be the first persons on Earth to get there. This hour, we'll talk about the pioneering scientific observations of those early Antarctic expeditions, from hunting for fossils and penguin eggs to investigations of global warming, plus a look at British explorer Robert Scott's long-lost photos of life on the icy continent. Finally, mosquitoes, genetically engineered to kill their own children. Why are some concerned about safety? And is this tactic effective enough to combat diseases like dengue fever? Some answers and your questions after this break, so stay with us. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Mosquitoes infect up to 100 million people with dengue fever every year, according to CDC estimates. There's no vaccine, there is no cure, other than keeping that person hydrated. There's little that doctors can do. So to control dengue fever today, we eliminate standing water where mosquitoes lay their eggs, we use insecticides, and for all our efforts, cases of dengue are still on the rise. But there may be a better solution, which my next guest writes about in Scientific American this month, a way to get at the problem using the mosquitoes themselves by engineering them to pass on lethal genes to their children, killing off new generations of the bloodsuckers one batch of eggs at a time. One company has already conducted tests of these mosquitoes in the wild, reducing the number of mosquitoes, they say. How safe is this technique? Might there be some unintended consequences to releasing these genetically engineered bugs? And is this tactic effective enough to warrant the risk? Bijal Trivedi is a freelance science writer and author of that feature on engineering mosquitoes in the current issue of Scientific American. You can find a link to her article on our website at sciencefriday.com. Bijal joins us from NPR in Washington. Welcome back to Science Friday, Bijal.
Oh, hi, Ira. Thank you.
Good to have you back. No longer just an intern.
Nope.
tell us about the, this is an interesting study. They genetically modify the mosquitoes.
That's right. The paper that actually just came out in Nature Biotechnology is the first one that the company is publishing about open field trials. And with their mosquitoes, the progeny die. So it's basically a death gene that they're passing down, and the mosquitoes lay the eggs, and but you know there are no offspring. Mm-hmm. They sent me down to Mexico to observe field trials of a field cage trials of another type of anti-dengue mosquito. And with those mosquitoes, they are engineered to just kill off the female offspring. So the idea is that you send out genetically modified males, they mate with the wild females, and when the offspring are born, the females don't make it. So it crashes the population very quickly.
So they have two different techniques then?
There are two different techniques. The British biotech company Oxitec did their trials in the Cayman Islands. And the field trials that I observed, which were all within cages, very large cages in the middle of a farming community on the edge of Tapachula, which is right near the Guatemalan border, those were in cage trials, and that was sort of the female-specific kill switch.
Does one kind, one technique have an advantage over the other?
In terms of the genetic capabilities of the mosquitoes, I don't think they know yet. But mm-hmm. in terms of practicality, the female kill switch might be better because with Aedes aegypti, which are the mosquitoes, the species that primarily spread dengue virus, you can literally dry these eggs, the mosquito eggs. And with the ones that were done in the Grand Caymans, you know, you have to pick out the sterile males and only release them. With the ones with the female kill switch, you can release, you know, you can release these mosquitoes. They'll mate with the wild females. They'll lay their eggs, and the males will survive and the females will just die in the water. They don't develop their wings and they can't fly and they just squat on the water and they die. So from a practical point, you don't have to just release males. You can let everybody out there and, only the males will survive.
Because it's the females that do the biting.
Yeah, they do the biting. They spread disease. They're the ones that you really don't want.
Yeah. So if the other ones, if males survive, we don't care because they're not.
Because they don't bother us.
I guess when speaking about males, that's a good thing sometimes.
Those genetically sterile males don't bother us.
Let's not go there. Let's talk about the trials, the field trials. There are no international laws that prevented them from trying these field trials out there?
No. I mean, and this is the really tricky thing here. The trials that were done in the Cayman Islands, on Grand Cayman Island, by the British biotech firm Oxitec, they released these mosquitoes. Now, they said they did some community engagement, and I'll tell you what that means. That means they sent out a pamphlet that they were releasing sterile mosquitoes, and they had basically a 5-minute spot on the daily, nightly news that they were doing these experiments. Mm-hmm. And then they started releasing them in this plot at, sort of an isolated end of the island. And no, there is no body that sort of polices these trials. And, when you're dealing with genetically engineered organisms, I mean, this is a very, very touchy issue. And for the trials in Mexico, they haven't done an open release yet. Everything is still in these gigantic, huge cages with a lot of biosecurity measures on the cages. And, Mexico has signed the Cartagena Protocol, which, governs how you move genetically modified organisms around. And so they're doing everything very by the book there. And it was only sort of after the trials were being done and were in progress on Grand Cayman that the scientists really sort of came out and said, hey, we've been doing this and these are the results. But they took a lot of people, including a lot of people in the field, by surprise.
Yeah. Well, what could be unintended consequences, the side effects of this?
They claim that the technology is very safe. And, the fact that, these mosquitoes do not do well after a couple, basically, I mean, they are engineered to die, mm-hmm. which is, if there's a problem, that's a good thing. They'll die off pretty quickly. Some people have said, you could be hurting some organism that depends on mosquitoes for food, and you could be affecting food webs. But what the proponents of the technology argue is that, this Aedes aegypti mosquito, it is native only to parts of West Africa, and it sort of hitched a ride on slave ships and on trade vessels about 400 years ago and spread everywhere. So it's really an invasive species. So what the scientists argue is, nobody's going to miss this mosquito if we drop the levels a bit. I mean, it's very, very hard to eradicate something. So what we're talking about is suppressing the population such that, you don't transmit the disease. We all know it's really hard to get rid of mosquitoes.
Well, how effective are these engineered mosquitoes at crashing that population?
Well, not the recent paper, but, at a meeting a year ago, Oxitec announced, and this hasn't, to my knowledge, been published yet, that, they had released not just a few mosquitoes, but 3 million mosquitoes in this area of the island over a period of 6 months, and they had managed to crash the mosquito population by 80%. And this is what they announced at the American Society for Tropical Medicine and Hygiene, annual meeting about a year ago. And so that's pretty dramatic, crashing a population by 80%. But like I said, they haven't published that release yet, that research yet.
Yeah. Let me go to Jackie in Arlington. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks. You kind of almost touched on what I was going to bring up, which is, you know, if you kill mosquitoes, are you eradicating an ecological niche? I mean, I'm a molecular biologist. I'm not afraid of transgenic organisms, but it does sound like this, and I've read just in the past few weeks about several others that are really targeting mosquitoes for eradication. I'm not sure that that's really smart, but you did kind of just touch on that you're not going to eradicate all of them, I guess.
What about in areas
where that's an indigenous species, though? I mean, maybe that's helpful in areas where it's invasive, but what about the areas that are maybe the worst affected?
Good question. Thank you, Jackie.
Well, the places that they're talking about are places where, you know, insecticides have failed, public health measures have failed, and you have this rising and falling of the population of mosquitoes. So, like I said, they're not talking. It's not eradication. Mm-hmm. It's something that could be done at peak mosquito season to really stem the population at a low level so that you wouldn't get disease transmission.
And when you say peak mosquito season, we're not talking about a mosquito here and there. Right.
It's really flying
all over the place.
We are. I mean, when I was down in Tapachula, I visited the community where these trial cages are installed. And they did a very broad, because, you know, GM has such a stigma attached to it that they wanted to go very by the book. They wanted to be very open with the community, get feedback from the community in terms of what they thought of having genetically modified organisms near them. And I sat with a family in there. Well, the houses are all open, so you can't prevent mosquitoes from coming in and out. I sat at the kitchen table with a family, and there wasn't a moment when I wasn't swatting myself. And I'm sure I looked ridiculous, but it was low mosquito season, and I was slapping myself probably every 10 seconds. I mean, it was swarming.
And so the family welcomed this.
I mean, they couldn't tell you. I mean, you know, you'd be hard pressed to find somebody who could understand the genetics, you know, in very, very well at the molecular level amongst the general community. But, you know, they understood, you know, the type of technology that was being brought in, and they welcomed it because the insecticides that they use to curb outbreaks, they're horrible. I mean, they were fogging one part of the town with the insecticide while I was visiting, and they actually refused to take me there because it's associated with breathing difficulties. So they didn't want me anywhere near the area where they were fogging. And then this family, two of the children had hemorrhagic dengue, and with hemorrhagic dengue, more people get dengue hemorrhagic fever than all the other hemorrhagic viruses combined. You know, we're talking Ebola and Marburg.
Right.
More people get this than all of those. So they'd had experience with the hemorrhagic form.
And they'd rather do this than try
that
again. All right, Bijola, thank you very much. We're running out of time. Bijil Trivedi is a writer and author of the feature on mosquitoes in the current issue of Scientific American. After the break, we're dialing the clock back 100 years, back to those first explorations of Antarctica. That would be going on about right now, 100 years ago. We'll talk about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Well, the holidays are right around the corner, and if you're already trying to get your holiday gift list together, may I request that you keep Science Friday in your thoughts. It may be hard to believe, but the bulk of our funding comes from private donations like yours. This is what goes to create the radio show, our podcast, website, social media, phone apps. So please give what you can, $5, $10, whatever works for you. We'll send you a tax-deductible receipt, and you can even make donations as a gift to someone else. Just visit our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the link to support us. And thanks. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. 100 years ago today, November 1911, two teams of explorers were racing to be the first to the South Pole. Roald Amundsen, a Norwegian explorer, led one party, British explorer and Royal Naval officer Robert Falcon Scott the other. Amundsen ultimately won the race. Scott and the other four members of his team died on the way back. But whereas the Norwegian team had one sole motivation, and that is making it to the pole and getting back, Scott's team had a second goal in mind, and that was conducting science along the way. And indeed, members of his expedition made many pioneering observations in Antarctica, tracking the movement of glaciers, studying ice crystals, collecting fossils, observing seals, penguins, killer whales. And one of my next guests writes about that scientific history in his new book, An Empire of Ice, Scott Shackleton and the Heroic Age of Antarctic Science. But of course, you have to document the trip, right? So aside from his other duties, Scott learned the art of photography while down in Antarctica, taking pictures around his home base and part of the way on his fateful trip to the pole. Pictures that were lost for decades, but now they have been found. My second guest has uncovered those long-forgotten photos in his new book, The Lost Photographs of Captain Scott, Unseen Images from the Legendary Antarctic Expedition. And you can see a few of them on our Science and Arts website if you go to sciencefriday.com/arts. Let me introduce my guests again. Edward Larson is the author of An Empire of Ice, Scott Shackleton and the Heroic Age of Antarctic Science. He's also professor of history and law at Pepperdine in Malibu, California. He joins us from WOSU in Columbus, Ohio. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Larson.
Delighted to be back. Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. David Wilson is the author of The Lost Photographs of Captain Scott, Unseen Images from the Legendary Antarctic Expedition. He joins us from the BBC in London. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Wilson.
Thank you very much.
Now, you are actually a descendant of the famous Dr. Wilson of that expedition, are you not?
I am. He was my grandfather's older brother, so my great-uncle.
Your great-uncle. What kind of science did Scott's Terra Nova expedition do in Antarctica? Edward Larson, give us a little overview.
Actually, it was sort of a predecessor of everything that's being done today. It was really a remarkable achievement. Edward Wilson, David Wilson's great-uncle, was in charge of the overall program, but his specialty was birds. He was studying the penguins especially, took an amazing winter journey. Shortly before he went on the polar expedition with Scott, he went to Cape Crozier to study the emperor penguins. There were other teams going out to study glaciology, geology. Fossils were very important. They were trying to document the connections between Antarctica and the other southern continents. They were doing oceanography. They were doing regular dredging of the water off the where their main base was by digging trenches through the ice and then dredging. They also checked the lakes for algae and different plants growing there. They were seismograph work. They took they were studying earthquakes, terrestrial magnetism, basically all the sorts of scientific research of the different types that we continue to do today. They were literally opening a new continent for science. They were the third in three British expeditions that were funded for that exact purpose of opening a new continent for science and potentially for empire.
So are you making the case in your book that Scott's secondary mission would be to get to the South Pole?
Well, that's how it started. You have a series of three expeditions. The first was a Scott's Discovery Expedition in 1901 that was organized by the Royal Society and the Royal Geographic Society in London, Royal Society being the world's foremost scientific association at that time, funded by the British government for the purpose of doing science. And they kept their ambition, Scott's ambition to reach the South Pole, quiet. They didn't talk about it. Clements Markman, who was the organizer, president of the Royal Geographic Society, certainly wanted to reach the South Pole. They fell far short. They went south with Edward Wilson, David's great uncle, and Ernest Shackleton. Tried to go toward the pole, fell short. But their expedition was billed primarily for science. Then Shackleton came back with his first expedition that he led, the Nimrod expedition, took along some really superb scientist. Edgeworth David, a member of the Royal Society, other top scientists. They peeled out, fanned out over the Ross Sea area collecting science. He, with Shackleton, his stated goal was to also reach the pole. He tried, fell 100 miles short, and then Scott came back with his own expedition, again, with this team of scientists who were going off in other directions. So it's tough to say which came first and which was second. Certainly Scott wanted to reach the pole that had become actually something of a British obsession. But they wouldn't have considered – it wouldn't have been proper in Edwardian England to not try to do proper science along the way. And it's the science that gave it a measure of respectability that a mere dash to the pole could never have commanded at that time.
Mm-hmm. David Wilson, being a part of the family, the Wilson family, of that expedition, were these photos that you discovered in somebody's scrapbook, or how did you find them?
I came across them over a glass of gin and tonic in a bar after a sail in London, and a gentleman came up to me and said, "You'll never guess what I've got in my collection." And I hazarded a couple of guesses, and the result was he said that he'd found the lost photographs of Captain Scott, at which point I nearly choked on the lemon. But I went round to his flat a couple of days later and looked at the photographs, and there were 109 contact prints, about 3 inches by 4 inches. They had the original cataloguing numbers visible on them, but they were in something of a muddle. The original catalogue had been lost. There were no identifications, and so beyond saying Scott had taken them, it took some years of work to identify them all and sort them all out.
And somebody had to teach Scott how to take photos, right?
Absolutely. Well, it goes along with what Ed was saying. You know, the important job of an explorer is to bring back records, you know, maps and scientific records and images of where you've been, so that the unknown becomes known. That's an important part of human progress. And originally, you know, if the Navy had conquered the world with cannon fire, it had mastered it with a pencil and paper. And the tradition of exploration art that all Royal Naval officers were taught to follow was founded by Captain Cook and his taking of a professional artist with him on his second expedition in 1775-6. And that was continued right through to Scott's day, and my great uncle on his first expedition was the sort of last practitioner where pencil and paper was more important than the camera as a means of making a scientific record. But Scott was, you know, he's from that era where science and human progress were taken as goods. You know, it's before our cynical age after World War One and Hiroshima, Nagasaki and World War II. You know, human progress was considered an unmitigated good. And he believed that the camera and modern technology could open up the polar regions. He developed the first motorized with tracked sledges, and he also invited a professional photographer on his second expedition specifically to improve the use of the camera for scientific exploration. Mm-hmm. And he invited Herbert Ponting along as that man, and he revolutionized the imaging of the polar regions.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking with Ed Larson, author of An Empire of Ice, Scott Shackleton and the Heroic Age of Antarctic Science, David Wilson, author of The Lost Photographs of Captain Scott, Unseen Images from the Legendary Antarctic Expedition. As I say, our number again, 1-800-989-8255. As someone who went to Antarctica and the South Pole back in 1979, all they talked about was the comparison. I remember they talked about the comparison of Scott and Amundsen. And Scott was basically seen as the amateur explorer compared to the knowledge that Amundsen brought with him, you know, having come from Norway and studied under Nansen and all these great explorers. And people seem to be trying to resurrect Scott's reputation all of those years. Do you see this? Did you have that in your mind, Ed Larson, when you were writing this book?
No, I did not have that particularly in my mind. I know it's happening. You can read it in the different books. I take nothing away from Amundsen. Giving credit to the science of Scott's expedition actually does take nothing away from Amundsen's achievement. Only the Norwegians reached the pole and returned safely, and they did so over an unknown route in less than 100 days with food to spare. Further, the pursuit of science doesn't excuse Scott for poor choices that, combined with forgivable misfortune, contributed to suffering and death on his polar journey. But it does give perspective, and it gives meaning to the British endeavor. And the one thing that Roland Huntford in his famous book about Scott and Amundsen didn't do was talk about the other aspects of Scott. Oh, he criticized Scott for Scott's mistakes, and Scott did make mistakes. Amundsen was certainly planned a better trip to the pole. But what Scott was also planning was a multifaceted, complex expedition. He had 32 men on the ice. He had teams going all over, where Amundsen had 30, and they were focused on one end. They did that one end better. But if you look at the overall expedition, actually, the British Terra Nova expedition, Scott's expedition, was actually more modern and a marvel of planning, if not execution.
There's a tweet came in from James Healy who says, didn't hauling rocks and things help contribute to the team's death?
Oh, you can certainly say that might have. I mean, their death was a... You could have a lot of but-for excuses. They might not have died but for the weather being colder. They might not have died but for the fact that they stopped and collected geological specimens, very important geological specimens, on the way back at the Beardmore Glacier when they were already highly stressed. But on the other hand, if you take those things away, it wouldn't be Scott. It wouldn't be a British expedition. British, when they traveled... And David mentioned Captain Cook. You can also James Clark Ross discovering this region. They took along artists. They took along geographers. They took along scientists, natural historians making collections. It wouldn't be a British expedition without those. And so while certainly they were stressed, just think of Edward Wilson, David's great uncle. Before going on the polar journey, he had made this death-defying midwinter journey to Cape Crozier to collect penguin eggs and studying the evolutionary development of penguins. Scott himself had gone in an opposite direction from the pole just a month before leaving for the pole to check movements of stakes that had been placed on a glacier to see how much the glacier had moved. Certainly all these activities made it much less likely for Scott to succeed. Still, he thought he had a margin of safety, that he could do all this science, and with the margin of safety provided by the enormous amount of resources he brought down, that he could still make it back safely. And the surprising thing was that there was a combination of mistakes and chance with the fuel leaking from the containers in the glacier, in the stores that they didn't expect, so they ran out of fuel, and the extraordinary cold that I know it's always cold in Antarctica, but it was even colder than normal, and it was that combination of taking risks, trying to do science, making mistakes. And misfortune. And it took them all combined because they came so close to getting back, only 11 miles from their supply depot.
Mm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Talking with Ed Larson and David Wilson. David, Ponting, the photographer, I think maybe that Ed talked with touching on this, had an extraordinary bad luck where there was one incident in particular with killer whales. Almost getting him? Tell us about that.
I'm not so much sure it was bad luck as just goes with the territory in those days. You know, they had big, heavy, cumbersome camera equipment and so on. And yes, he used to get people to pose on icebergs and they fell off icebergs. And he was trying to film killer whales and then they decided that they'd try and eat him and came up under the ice, bumping it in the technique that they have, and decided they'd quite like him for lunch. So he nearly got eaten by killer whales. And on another occasion, he licked his lips whilst taking a photograph, and his tongue stuck to a little part of the metalwork on the camera, and it froze to the camera, and he had to jerk his head away and left the tip of his tongue stuck to the camera.
Wow.
So they were hazardous times for explorers.
Yeah. I did that with a stenography pad when I was in Antarctica. I got it off pretty fast. So. Those little curlicue, you know, on the top of the pad. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones to Kirsten in Berkeley. Hi, Kirsten.
Hi, I was calling to say that I have a lot of undocumented photographs from Amundsen's expedition because my grandfather, Magnus Eriksson, was there from Spitsbergen all the way through. And I heard great stories about polar bears and fires and all kinds of things that had happened. I don't have anything to add to the science. I think it's really great what you're doing.
So let me interrupt, Kirsten. You say you have photographs no one has seen from Amundsen's expedition?
Yes, that I inherited from my grandfather.
Anybody interested?
I think everyone would be interested in seeing those if you took them into a museum.
I have photographs. I have maps and some things from my grandfather.
Wow.
And I think even pictures of Mussolini and all kinds of stuff.
Well, David and I were together just last week in Ireland at the Shackleton, a major Shackleton conference, and the people from the Fram Museum in Norway were there, I'm sure. And David's book is beautiful, by the way. I'm sure there are lots of museums would be very interested. Right here at Ohio State, Bird Polar would be very interested in those, but so would the Fram Museum. So would Scott, the Scott Archives in the yeah. Scott Institute in Cambridge.
Take them out of the attic, Kirsten. Bring them out so we can all see.
They're in a box. I pull them out and I look at them all the time because I grew up with the childhood stories of the expedition. So I would be, if anybody would like my contact information, I won't give it over the phone, but I will give it to somebody and they can contact me.
All right. We'll put you on hold and And we'll take your contact information. You're in Berkeley. There's got to be a lot of people in Berkeley who can help you out.
Yes. If somebody can just put me in touch, that would be great.
Okay. Well,
I'll actually be there next semester at Stanford, and I'd be delighted to come over and look at those photographs. Okay. It'd be an honor.
Okay.
Don't hang up, Kirsten. I'm going to put you on hold.
I'm not hanging up.
All right. Good luck with that. That was very, very interesting. One other thing is that, you know, she talked about Shackleton. Shackleton had his own photographer. He had a guy with a movie camera, didn't he? On his trip. Mm-hmm. Gorgeous.
Yep, he did. Frank Hurley went south first with Douglas Mawson at about the same time as Scott went south taking Ponting. But his photographs weren't particularly better than the average for the period. It was only when he studied Ponting's film and Ponting's photograph from Scott's expedition that he learnt the techniques that really worked in the Antarctic, and that was what enabled him to produce those amazing photographs and the astonishing film for Shackleton's second expedition. So the key is Herbert Ponting's work, and you know, all photography up to this day is a footnote to Ponting's effort. Even David Attenborough's programs find their roots in Herbert Ponting.
We're going to get more into that and talk more about the lost photographs of Captain Scott, unseen images from the legendary Antarctic expedition, and An Empire of Ice, Scott Shackleton and the Heroic Age of Antarctic Science. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/scifry. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the heroic age of Antarctic exploration 100 years ago today and some of the scientific observations that were made on those early trips and some gorgeous photographs that came back that were made by Robert Falcon Scott. Ed Larson is the author of An Empire of Ice, Scott Shackleton and the Heroic Age of Antarctic Science. And David Wilson is the author of The Lost Photographs of Captain Scott, Unseen Images from the Legendary Antarctic Expedition. And I want to, David, I want to talk to you about those photographs. But before I do, let me just set the stage. 100 years ago today, Ed, where were they at this point?
Well, 100 years ago today, Scott had just left. He left his base on November 1st. So he was still traveling with the entire contingent of forces that he was bringing to bear on getting south. So he had his tractors that David's already told you about, developed these new tractors. They hadn't yet broken down. They would break down very soon. He had ponies pulling sledges. That was an innovation that Shackleton had worked on. He had dogs pulling sledges, and he had himself and others on foot. And they were heading down very slowly. They weren't far past the beginning. And the idea was that these different teams, this vast number of people, what they'd do is they would fall back in stages. It would be like an Apollo rocket. They would go a ways, and then they'd drop off supplies, and the tractors stopped, and then the horses would fall back, and then the dogs. Now, Amundsen was much further along. He originally left in September, found out it was too cold, went back, and then left in mid-October. Now, he was traveling very rapidly, only with men that would go the entire way. There were dog sledges, these sleds being pulled, 52 dogs he was starting with in these large teams of 13, 14 dogs pulling a sled, and the cross-country skiers, expert alpine cross-country skiers. Amundsen had learned how to mush dogs when he took his Northwest Passage. He was the first person to make the Northwest Passage. And they were speeding along. At this point, they were speeding along. what's now known as the Ross Ice Shelf, and then heading up the glacier toward the pole.
And Amundsen would mush his dogs all the way up there and actually eat them as part of their food. But Scott just had manhauled those sledges. There were no animals involved during the last pushes up there.
Right. The idea was that he had pretty well determined that the ponies could make it across the Ross Ice Shelf, which is at sea level. But because Shackleton had – the ponies had failed by falling into the huge crevasses going up the Beardmore Glacier, that ponies couldn't make it up that. So the idea was to manhaul. Now, they had used dogs on the first Discovery expedition, but the trick with they'd used dogs to pull their sleds, but it hadn't worked very well. The trouble is it's very hard to mush dogs, as anybody who's ever done it knows, and the British hadn't mastered that skill. And so if you're not mushing the dogs right, it's just a mess. They're pulling in different directions. The British even tried to manhaul and use dogs at the same time, and dogs won't pull with humans. And that combination of events, coupled with the fact that Shackleton had almost made it to the pole, within 100 miles of the pole, by manhauling up the glacier and across, led Scott to believe that was the way to go. One other fact has to be remembered, and that is Scott didn't know he would be in a race. He thought that he was the only one going. So he, sounds ironic today, he had planned his trip for safety, where Amundsen, from the get-go, knew it was a race. He hadn't announced he was going to the South Pole. He had publicly announced he was going to the North Pole and then turned on a dime and went south. And so while by the time Scott left, he knew that Amundsen had come south, when he planned his trip, with the ponies and the horses and ponies and the dogs and the tractors, he wasn't anticipating a race. He was planning for safety. So it turned out that it was a very unequal race if you're just talking about speed.
Yeah. David Wilson, from an artistic point of view, in these photos of yours in your book are just fantastic. Do they serve as mere documentation of the trip, or do they aspire to something more? Because there are some beautiful photographs of the snow there.
They aspired to considerably more than just documentation. Scott and Ponting were about replacing the tradition of exploration art with the camera. So they wanted to replace the use of sketch pad and pencil with cameras for scientific purposes. But I don't think that even Scott or Ponting realized quite how radical the photographic program was going to turn out to be. Ponting was one of the finest landscape photographers of his time. And he took with him the tradition of Victorian photography. So he produced the most beautiful landscapes, very carefully posed. He would wait for hours for the penguins to get into exactly the right shape to echo the shapes of the mountains behind. All the images were carefully composed. And he produced the most astonishing photographs taken, certainly to that date. He also produced pictures in the Victorian tradition of the sublime, you know, small human figures set in vast icy landscapes. But he was also starting to produce, to sort of push the aesthetic tastes of the time and was taking him. He got interested when he was down there in the form and the texture and the shape of ice. And so he started to take photographs, which are really a form of proto-modernism. They foreshadow modernism by about 20 years. So they're very, very 20th century photographs. And they weren't particularly popular with the Edwardians when they were sent home. So they tend to get forgotten about. But Scott was taught by Ponting in all those traditions, and it shows in his photographs. But Scott went one further than Ponting. He also there was a little bit of reportage in his methods, but he also wanted to take action photographs. I think that's a reflection of the man and his character, you know. And so he started taking some action photographs, which are absolutely stunning. I mean, some of the scenes taken on the way to the pole are absolutely amazing. But the primary purpose was scientific, and most of Ponting's images are actually of the life cycles of the birds and the seals and the penguins and all sorts of, you know, different aspects of Antarctic wildlife. They don't often get shown these days, but they were for use in the scientific reports when they got home. And he used, even with his those sorts of photographs, they're all very carefully taken, very carefully composed. You know, the skewer chicks are put up against rulers so everyone can see what size they are, that sort of thing. But he also had a film camera with him, and with that he pioneered the modern wildlife documentary and paved the way, as I say, for well, Walt Disney and David Attenborough, really, in their sort of sequences of wildlife films over the 20th century. And he started to use film as a method of recording life cycles, but he also started making scientific breakthroughs with film. So he was the first to record the Weddell seal making its hole in the ice with its teeth and with his film. And he was very proud about that because it disproved a theory of my great uncle's as to how they kept their holes open through the winter. And so, you know, that's the breakthrough. Prior to that, there had been film in the Antarctic, but it was always sort of entertainment. You know, there's a famous sequence of film from the Scottish expedition where they play bagpipes at emperor penguins and that sort of thing. But this was the first time filmmaking got serious for science in the Antarctic. And it transformed cinema, and people forget that. People tend to dismiss Ponting as Scott's photographer, but he actually pushed 19th century photography into 20th century photography, and he pioneered film. His was the first film to receive a Royal Command performance, which meant it was shown to the King, and every year ever since there's been a Royal Command film for the monarch of the period, and prior to that, that was an honour that was only given to the high arts, to opera and ballet and so on. So it was the birth of cinema in some ways, in this country anyway.
Hmm. It's quite interesting. The book is quite beautiful with those photos that were brought back. Ed Larson, I always thought it was unusual that after following Scott's and his party's death and then went and after the winter was over and they went back and found the bodies, they didn't bring the bodies back with them. Why is that?
Well, there were various reasons for that, but look where they all ended. Shackleton and Amundsen also ended up in polar realms, and that's where their bodies lie. They had first it would have been awkward and difficult because then they'd have to, once they got them back, they'd have to bring them back on the ship. But here they found them in the tent where they died in a dramatic pose, actually. Wilson and Bowers are at the side in an attitude of sleep, and Scott is open with his arm flung out, his sleeping bag half open, arms flung out across Wilson. They had with them the rocks, the geological specimens that they'd collected. They had brought those all the way back to where they died. They had their diaries. They had their journals, which were written up, almost ready for publication. And it seemed fitting that at that place they build a large cairn of ice, because what would happen would be then it would be covered over the years and sink down into the glacier, into the Ross ice shelf, and then move gradually out to sea. So that the best anybody can tell, about this time, the chunk of ice that entombs Wilson, Bowers, and Scott will break loose and float into the sea. And to the people on that expedition, that seemed to be the appropriate way to commemorate what they had achieved.
1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. Let's go to John in San Rafael, California. Hi, John.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a biologist who studies whales, and a lot of the historical information that we have about whales and whale biology comes from that pioneering work that the British did in the Antarctic, the British Antarctic Survey folks. And also one of the tools that we use as whale biologists now is photography to document individuals and follow individuals over time. So it struck me how important the books that your two guests have are to the field of marine biology and studying whales specifically. So I'm looking forward to reading both books. And all that work in the Antarctic was so critical to what we know about whales today.
Let me just remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from NPR. Go ahead. Did you want to react to that?
Well, reaching his point, he is absolutely correct. I want to thank the caller for his observations. The Discovery Expedition, which was Scott's first, was designed to follow up on the Great Challenger Expedition, the expedition of the British of the 1880s, which went around into the Southern Ocean. And that was designed in part to follow up on Ross's expedition and on before that on Cook's. So it was a series of British expeditions. Many of these were designed with part in mind whales. Whales were an important part of the economy then. They were monitoring the whales. Scott was very interested in the whales. They did take the photographs. David has beautifully described the type of photographic work they did, and I agree with him. I studied it closely. They viewed this as an integral part of the scientific research they were doing. That was also part of the reason why they moved to filming. To catch movies, to make movies of the whales and especially the penguins. They'd come back from the Discovery Expedition, says, no one can capture these penguins unless you do it with a movie. And so Shackleton, Amundsen, Scott came back in part to capture these penguins and the way they moved in movies, partly for entertainment, to be sure, and certainly they are entertaining, and they became a rage in Edwardian England, but also as a part of, as a critical part of scientific research. So the penguins, the whales, the seals, this was a central part of what these all these expeditions were about.
David, did they actually have a dark room down there in Antarctica?
They did have a dark room. Ponting had his own dark room in the hut in which he developed a lot of the film. He actually had the only private space in the expedition hut, so they certainly took it seriously. On the precise question of whales, the Terra Nova expedition was equipped to sample whales in the Antarctic. They took with them some harpoons and things. My great uncle at the time was involved in one of the great illustrative projects illustrating the standard work of British mammals. And the third volume, of which was never published because he died, was on the Cetacea. And he wasn't terribly happy with the paintings and illustrations he'd made, and he wanted to study whales in more depth. But they'd also spotted species on the Discovery Expedition they thought were new species, and they wanted to see if they could collect samples, which is why they took the harpoons with them and so on. So they were certainly very, very interested in studying the whales, and the Natural History Museum was interested in them bringing specimens home.
I want to interrupt because we only got a minute left, but I want to touch on one thing that was quite interesting to learn about, and that was about that they were also studying global warming at that time there.
Oh, they were tremendously interested in global warming because they had, by this time during the 1800s, they discovered that Europe had once been covered by glaciers and that the shape of Europe was shaped by these glacial retreats. And they very much, that was very much a part of the itinerary for the Discovery Expedition and then the Nimrod and the Terra Nova, was that this is one place where they could study glaciers that are still of the size that were in Europe. They noted the retreat and they documented the retreat of the glaciers in Antarctica. They were trying to study how much it retreated, how it moved out of dry valleys. Scott had discovered the first dry valleys in the Antarctic during his Discovery Expedition. They were documenting global warming, climate change over time.
Quite interesting, and let me just repeat the names of the books. They're terrific books. An Empire of Ice, Scott Shackleton, and The Heroic Age of Antarctic Science by Edward Larson, and David Wilson is author of The Lost Photographs of Captain Scott, Unseen Images from the Legendary Antarctic Expedition. David, are there any other photos left? Do you think you have them all?
Oh, I don't know. I know we don't have them all, and I'm rather hoping that, like your lady caller earlier, somebody's got them hiding in their attic.
All right.
And if they have, perhaps they'd call you and tell me.
Right. Well, we have the number. We'll get you in touch with her and see. She did mention something about polar bears, so we're not quite sure that's the South Antarctica or not. So maybe he went some other places and had some other photos also. So thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Great, thank you so much.
Great books. Thank you for writing them. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Taliata and Alessio Bayak. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. I'm Ira Flato. Thanks for listening.